Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Digitally Uploaded podcast. I'm Matt Sainsbury, the editor-in-chief of digitallydownloaded.net. And with me this week, we've got an all-star cast. First up is Ginny. Hello, Ginny.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
I'm good. And we've also got Trent. Hello, Trent.
Hello.
So, it's been a big week. Lots of stuff's happened. Most excitingly of all, I guess, is it was Nier Automata's one-year birthday. Happy birthday to the best game ever made. Hooray. And stuff. Hopefully everybody's played it by now. If not, what are you waiting for? Go and play it.
Trent, have you played this?
Oh, no. I say no.
And now I find the mute button for Trent for the rest of the podcast. I honestly can't believe after I've been saying that it's the best game of all time for like the last year. Exactly. And even before, because I was even saying that before the game was even out and I was right. I can't believe Trent hasn't played it. I'm a bit offended, really. So I'll need some Hatsune Miku music to cheer me up, I guess. Let's listen to The Humorous Dream of Mrs. Pumpkin. This is an oddball track. It's good fun, though. So enjoy, and we'll be back and talking about the games of March. Welcome back, everybody. Okay, so it's the last week of February as we record this, or when you listen to this, so we'll go through the games of March for the first section of the podcast this week. So running through them, on the PlayStation 4, we have, where are we? It starts off relatively slow this month, but really picks up towards the back end of it. Bravo Team comes out on March 6th, which is a VR shooter thing, and actually I enjoyed it when I played it. So it should be all right. VR is always good. Then we've got a little bit later on the 25th Ward, The Silver Case, comes out on March 13. That's the sequel to The Silver Case, which is a really good visual novel and was actually Goichi Suda's first project when he went independent and started up Grasshopper Manufacture. So the sequel was Japan only and on mobiles only, and now it is on console, which is good, should be a good game. For people who haven't played Devil May Cry yet, those people, including Trent, I guess, play the Devil May Cry HD collection comes out in March, which will be good. Attack on Titan 2 for Attack on Titan fans, that's out on March 20. Assassin's Creed Creed Rogue Remastered comes out on March 20 as well. That's probably, well, that's right up there with my favorite Assassin's Creed games. Never got the attention it deserved because it was released on the PS3 when they also released Unity on the PS4, and it was much better than Unity. So that's that should be good in HD. Ni no Kuni 2 Revenant Kingdom finally comes out on March 23. I've played around with that a little bit, and it's really good. Far Cry 5, we'll skip past that. Atelier Lady and Sul, I don't even know if I pronounced those names right, but it's the newest Atelier game, and that's always a good thing. Atelier is the best. It comes out on March 27, and on the exact same day, The Witch and the Hundred Knight 2 comes out. So that's an awful lot of JRPG gaming at the end of the month. And Code Realize, which is a visual novel that's well worth getting interested in, that comes out on March 30. So that's the PS4. The Switch has a pretty quiet month, I think, ahead of it.
No, I'm pretty sure there's some games coming out in March.
Well, you still got to catch up on Bayonetta anyway, so you're right.
but
actually, the first of March brings Damascus Gear to the Switch, and that's actually a decent-ish little grainy action robot-y game. Played it on the PS4, it's a much better fit for the handheld, so it should work well on the Switch. What do we got? Bleed 2. Kirby comes out on March 16. There we go. Kirby's always good. Both of the Koei Tecmo games also come out on the Switch, so Attack on Titan 2 and Atelier. And then we've got, well, that's about it, really. Like I said, a relatively quiet month for the Switch if you would prefer to play your Koei Tecmo games on PS4. Otherwise, you've got plenty to look forward to. So, that's that. Ginny, what are you looking forward to this month?
Well, I'm kind of insulted that you didn't mention Detective Pikachu, actually.
I didn't. I didn't have the 3DS list in front of me because the 3DS list is basically one game, which is Detective Pikachu.
Yeah,
but yes, it's like absolutely. A game of the month.
Absolutely. I can't believe I forgot that. I feel very bad. Sorry to everybody, and I feel very bad. Sorry.
So I'm definitely going to be looking at Detective Pikachu, Ni no Kuni 2, because I am a Ni no Kuni fan, and also getting into Atelier. In terms of, I guess, games that are a little less JRPG, Japanese orientated, I'll be picking up Warhammer Vermintide 2, I think, because I really enjoyed the first one, just in terms of what it brought to the table as a multiplayer game. And like, Vermintide is a game that I really like jamming with my brother and my friends. So I'll probably get Warhammer Vermintide 2 on top of that. And Kirby Star Allies, I'm kind of on the fence about. I love me a little bit of Kirby, but I mean, it's just, it kind of does seem like it's a game that's more fun with co-op, and not enough of my friends also have the same affection for Kirby. So it's a maybe, but I think I'll be pretty busy just with Detective Pikachu and Ni no Kuni alone, discounting the other stuff that I'm going to pick up. So yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But that'll be more than enough. I mean, Detective Pikachu, yeah, it just looks like crazy good fun. And then, yeah, Ni no Kuni has the impression, it just from the short demo I played of it, it looks like it's probably even bigger in scope than the original. And the original is, what, 60, 70-hour game. So, yeah, you're looking at a big one with that. So,
oh, no, I have that pre-ordered.
Yeah, it's gonna be a big one. Okay, so you're gonna be playing that one, Trent. What else? I assume
yes, I am.
Pikachu.
Yes, Detective Pikachu. I'm repurchasing Life is Strange just so I can get the Rachel and Chloe figurines.
Wow.
But I guess in terms of games which we haven't mentioned already, probably A Way Out. I know it's a very Western focused game, but the one which is, it's basically set in the prison. You have to escape. And
oh, that's the one by the people that
yeah.
Know others, right?
Yeah.
So
when it was announced during E3 all those years ago, me and my friend were like, this looks really, really awesome. Did you see that? And they're like, yes. And then we're going to play it when it comes out, which is evidently this month. So whatever platform he gets it on, I'll get it and we'll play the game.
Nice.
Yeah, I can't believe I forgot about that one completely. Like, it was on the list in front of me and I just skipped over it. But yeah, that's a good looking game. And the heritage of the developer is really strong. So that's one well worth looking forward to from the indie side of things, I guess. But yeah, in terms of what I'm playing, I'm such an Atelier tragic that that's the one I'm definitely looking forward to the most by a long margin. This Atelier closes off the trilogy that they started on the PS4, which was Atelier Sophie and then Atelier Firis. And Firis was my favorite Atelier game since way back on the PS3 with Maruru. So yeah, I'm really, and I played a demo of it at TGS and I was really impressed with the art style. It's got a very different art style because of the whole painting thing. In this game, you jump into paintings and they're all different worlds. And yeah, it's got that painterly look, which is really nice and really suits the Atelier series well. I'm a little bit disappointed that Koei is releasing this as the first Atelier on Switch, because people who haven't got PS4s or maybe didn't look at the series before, they're going to find it difficult to perhaps jump into it because it is the third in the trilogy. They are independent games, but they all kind of reference back to previous games in the series. So yeah, it's an interesting one. I hope it sells well enough that perhaps Koei looks at porting the other two in the trilogy to the Switch as well. That'd be good.
Well, I'll probably pick it up if you keep complaining I haven't played it.
Bayonetta first.
Bayonetta yeah, first. Yeah. No, the Switch has had such a strong last year and then into this year. I think we can let it have a quieter month. I'm not interested in Kirby at all, I must admit. No, that's blasphemy. But cute as Kirby is, this one's not really doing it for me. And I get this strong impression that this is Nintendo just making sure they had a release in March to keep the Switch going until, I don't know, what comes out in April? Something good, I assume.
Nintendo Labo.
Oh, yeah, there you go. So Nintendo's got some big stuff coming and they just needed to fill a month. So it's interesting, though. It's the one-year anniversary for the Switch next month. Can't believe it's only been
very
out.
Very exciting.
Yeah, I can't believe it's only been out a year. It feels like it's a device that I can't remember not having. it's something that I play pretty much every day and I take it with me everywhere. And yeah, I don't know. What was I doing beforehand? Playing the Vita, I guess. Poor Vita. Rest in peace.
Or using the Wii U on the couch.
Yeah, I'd have been. I've packed away the Wii U because I don't really need it anymore. And the Switch is, once the Switch gets the ports of a couple more of the Wii U games, then we're all set. So get on with doing that Tokyo Mirage Sessions HD, and I'm pretty good.
Well, I'm pretty sure it's almost there. The Hyrule Warriors is the next game, which is getting a port, and obviously Smash is going to come out at some point, either a port or a remake, and you know, the only real things you're missing on are all the Zelda remakes which got done for it. And, you know, yeah, it's pretty much everything's been ported to the Switch already.
Well, there were three that I really want that haven't already been announced. It's the Project Zero 5, Xenoblade Chronicles X, and Tokyo Mirage Sessions. We're getting strong hints that Xenoblade Chronicles X is coming. It's just those other two that are still big question marks. I think Tokyo Mirage Sessions probably won't happen simply because I don't know the relationship between Nintendo and Atlas, but that always seemed like a marriage of convenience.
Plus, Nintendo, it's a very niche title from when
Nintendo needed a JRPG for the Wii U. Atlas obviously had cutting room floor rejects from Persona 5 that it could stitch together into a game. So they partnered up and that's where we got Tokyo Mirage Sessions from. And I think Atlas has got other things to worry about now. And I think Nintendo does too. So I don't think we'll see a port of that, unfortunately. Project Zero is a possibility. Nintendo owns that franchise and they may well think that, you know, throwing out a port on Halloween is a good way of doing the season. Yeah. So there's a chance of that, but yeah. So on all of that note, we'll jump to some music. I've picked some music from Atelier, actually, because, yeah, I like it, and I'm looking forward to it this month. So this is actually Atelier Rarona from way, way back. It's actually the first Atelier game I played and was what got me into the series. So this one's got working to music, just warning in advance. We'll come back and we'll talk about Donald Trump next. Welcome back, everybody. Okay, so the big news this week in terms of the impact that it will have on the games industry comes in the wake, I guess, of the massive tragedy that happened over in the US with the school and the shooting. Yeah, they should really look into those gun laws, I think. But anyway, Donald Trump's solution to that, being the awesomely intelligent president that he is, was to propose putting more restrictions on violent games, or setting up a classification board for games, ignoring the fact that the ESRB already exists in the US. It would seem that he is looking for someone or something to blame that's not the NRA for those tragedies when they happen, and it looks like games are in his sight, which is not unusual, I guess. Every couple of years something happens that really puts the games right back in the spotlight. But yeah, it's been an interesting week for the industry. And of course, every media outlet has been pulling out all those articles that prove all the scientific evidence to suggest that games don't turn people into psychopaths, which is something we all kind of knew, I guess. I think we've all played violent games in the past and we haven't felt the urge to go shooting up schools. At least I hope you two haven't. I assume you both haven't. But yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous, right? It's just ridiculous that every time something bad happens, the first thing that's in the sights is the violent video games.
Yeah, I think games are an easy scapegoat, just because there's a lot of misinformation and misunderstanding about games for quite a large portion of just regular people in society. Like, often, like, you hear the whole games make children violent argument trotted out by parents and some teachers in New Zealand and Australia, like, constantly. And it's just basically a flood of misinformation. Like, a lot of people that are fundamentally opposed to games are not people that actually play games. Like, I think it's going to be very rare to find someone, and I don't have any mates that I've talked to who have been like, oh, I've played Call of Duty, now I want to kill a bunch of people in a foreign country. Like, I think it's just the people sort of focus exclusively on games about killing and warfare and go, oh, this is ruining our children. And that kind of attitude also translates into how people view other games of other mediums and genres and sort of see them as like social dysfunction. Like, one example, I think, which we all are familiar with at DDNet here, is games like Omega Labyrinth and stuff like that. And how you'll, and even lesser, I guess, games that are less quote unquote offensive to most people's sensibilities and that include mature women like Senran Kagura, you often find someone on the internet just angry about these games existing and saying that they contribute in some way to, you know, like systemic misogyny and exploitation of women. And these people are often people that are not going to play the game or will play 10 minutes of it and then write a 200-word piece about how terrible the game is. And I just feel like people, I don't know if it's games as a medium or if it's the vast vocal minority of people that play games and are real assholes about it, But something is stopping, or I guess not preventing, but something is stopping people from actually playing the games that they yell about, and understanding that games in themselves are not dangerous. I mean, I don't know. I guess I wish there was a way to change that attitude.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that's always amused me just on your first point is that whenever this happens and everybody rolls out the article saying that games don't cause violence and games don't turn people into serial killers and all that kind of stuff, which is true, the science is there to prove it, 2 weeks later they are out there also writing opinion pieces about how whatever game from Japan will turn people into, you know, a serial pervert. And the fact that, you know, it just doesn't, you know, the logic doesn't click in their head that, hey, you know, maybe the same kind of science applies to games that aren't violent but have, you know, bikinis in them. I just don't understand how people can be like that. As far as I'm concerned, the science is quite there to demonstrate that people who play a game and then perhaps act on impulses that are less than healthy probably had those impulses before they played the game anyway. And, you know, to blame the game for it is to put a scapegoat there that doesn't deal with the underlying problem. And it's not just games. Games are the ones that are targeted at the moment, but you go back 20 years, if somebody was a serial killer, people would look at their video collection, their movie collection, and see if they're into horror films, for example. I remember when I was growing up playing Dungeons & Dragons, there was a proportion of the community that thought that people who play Dungeons & Dragons are going to become Satanists and nonsense like that. And we laugh about it now, but, you know, these are the things that people scapegoated before games were the major kind of thing, the major youth culture thing. So I think it's more to do with, you know, people look for the dominant kind of force within youth culture and pin the blame on that because they don't really understand it. At the moment, that happens to be games. So as unfortunate as it is, we do have to deal with it. One thing that we can help as a community, I feel, is firstly being more consistent about how we report about these things. We can't go around and say that something is unhealthy for the community on one hand and then say that, oh, but, you know, the games I like don't affect me on the other. And the other thing we can do is stop making violence such the focus of video games. Because I think one thing that kind of causes it is somebody who doesn't really have a clue about what's going on, such as Donald Trump, would look at something like, you know, how games are presented in game shows like E3 and whatever. And 90% of what you see on E3 is a bunch of men going berserk over stabbing people in the throat with knives and stuff. And, you know, I remember 2 years ago, Bethesda gets up and talks about Doom, three years ago, whatever. They're going up and talking about Doom, and the moment they mentioned gore and violence and extreme gore, and I think it was lots of blood or something, the crowd went berserk and cheering. And, you know, that kind of thing doesn't help the industry, I feel. We need to be more mature about how we handle violence as a topic in games, and we're not. And I think that's, you know, the violence isn't going to cause people to do something, but we're certainly not helping our own cause by going berserk over shooting people in the head.
Sorry.
I was just saying it would be interesting if, by mistake, if Donald Trump accidentally does impact the video game industry by accidentally being right, you know, two times, you know, in a day sort of thing, and ends up, you know, revolutionizing how propaganda sort of games, which are heavily shooting-based games like a Call of Duty, end up being impacted and represented in the industry just because they're the biggest violence games which you see are these games and these shooters where they're essentially propaganda. And for most people, they're the games which you read up and go, well, this is what I'm complaining about. I'm complaining about Call of Duty. It's turning my kid crazy sort of thing, something like that, or GTA. Those sort of games, it'll be interesting to see if somehow he accidentally makes the industry more aware of what they're actually presenting and maybe tone down some of those very heavy games which are presented very propaganda-like.
Yeah, I mean, it's an issue. And as anybody who reads my articles know, I have I have issues with how games like Call of Duty present their content, their material, their stories. And I would like for there to be a more mature discussion about this stuff. At the moment, one of the great issues I have with how this stuff happens is that, you know, a Donald Trump like accuses the video games of causing people to go commit murder. The video games industry goes, well, no, look, here's the science. And that's the end of the discussion. It's more nuanced than that. A game might not cause somebody to do something, but a game is certainly reflective of the society that's built around it, because otherwise the game wouldn't sell in the first place. So the fact that the extreme violence is what sells and what becomes the dominant focus of events like E3, and, you know, this and the context in which that violence is presented, like you said, it's often heavily nationalist and propaganda towards, you know, promoting patriotic attitudes or whatever you want to call it. That is certainly a discussion we need to have, but it needs to be more mature than saying, oh, a game's going to cause you to go and become a serial murderer, or no, a game doesn't do anything to you. There's more nuance to it than that.
Yay.
Yeah, so I think we've tapped out that hard and heavy discussion. I apologize to all our listeners to listening to that, but we needed to get it off our chest and have our own two cents on it, I think.
I feel like Matt needed to get it off his chest.
I have things to say, and, you know, now's the time to talk about it since it is, you know, relevant and on topic. So, yeah, I promise next week we'll be back to crazy cast and talking about nonsense. But we'll go to some music. I've picked some lovely music from Golden Sun to listen to for a bit of retro RPG pleasantries. We'll come back and we'll talk about something a lot of fun, Danganronpa. Danganronpa is a great game, so see you in a minute. And welcome back, everybody. Okay, so we're all in a better mood now. We're going to talk about something that's really interesting and fun. We're talking about Danganronpa for our in-depth look into one game that we do each week. The reason we've picked Danganronpa is actually as simple as Spike Chunsoft has come out with a tweet saying that they're going to announce four new games at GDC this year. So I don't know when GDC happens. It's probably, what, a week or two away or something. So we probably won't know about which those four games are until then. But we're all betting that one of them will be something to do with Danganronpa, since that seems to be Spike's money spinner at the moment. And we thought we'd look back at the first one and where it all started. So, Ginny, Danganronpa 1, what do you think is great about it?
What do I think is great about Danganronpa 1? I think it's just the way that it sort of blends... the way it sort of blends that high school, very typical, what I would see as a JRPG setting, like a high school, and it blends it with this sort of like dark sort of like Ace Attorney for adults, kind of like trying to figure out what's gone wrong here. And I think for me initially, when I first played this game, that was the most compelling part, was I just didn't know what I was playing. I was like, what is happening here? Like, I'm just enjoying my life at school, and then all of a sudden everything's upside down, people are dying. It's just the sheer ridiculousness of it was what really grabbed me initially. But I also just really enjoy, for me, the trials So as someone who obviously who has a legal background, the way that they parody, I guess, actual trials and have all these like have all this ammunition available to them in the form of evidence, I found that really interesting and amusing. So I guess for me, it's the gameplay elements that really kept me playing the game after the ridiculous premise is what drew me in. And I mean, I think that my favorite part of the game is probably the bear. It's Monokuma. It's just, you really have to play this game to experience what I'm talking about, because Monokuma is like an entity on its entity all on its own. Like, it's just one of the, it's like, I wouldn't want to call him, I guess, the driving force behind the game, but he really sort of is like this embodiment of despair and pain. And if you're wondering why an embodiment of despair and pain is hanging around a kid's high school, you have to play this game. It is just everything from the premise to how the game executes this whole judge, jury, executioner concept. Forgive my execute pun. But I just find that really, really fascinating. And it's the first of its kind that I played. In 2010, I think it was. And that sort of hooked me to the franchise ever since.
Yeah, I mean, for me, Monokuma was definitely the thing that pulled me into the game in the first place. I just liked how kind of subversive he is through everything he does and everything he kind of represents. Because the thing that really kind of struck me was that Monokuma himself doesn't... he's positioned as the villain and we're meant to see him as the bad guy. But really, he doesn't do the bad stuff. He basically, you know, it's very Saw-like, you know, like the film franchise, and the film certainly inspired the game. The Spike Chunsoft director came out and said that and stuff. So, you know, the bad guy himself just kind of puts the context, puts the scenario in play, and then lets people's, you know, humanity take over. And the thing that we're meant to be most, I guess, frightened of is the way that people behave towards one another within these kinds of, you know, high stakes contests. And I find that from kind of a moral philosophy point of view very interesting, because that's kind of my jazz, and that's what I really got into when I was back at uni. And, you know, the kind of the rare few games that deal with the topic in an interesting way generally pull me right in. And that's certainly what Monokuma represents. I don't see him as the bad guy as such. I see him as more the mirror to, you know, the real villains in the world, and that is, you know, people being people. So yeah, that was certainly what pulled me into it, and then I stayed for the waifu.
Don't we all?
Yeah. No, Trent. I mean, you don't play too many visual novels. So what was it about Danganronpa that kind of pulled you in?
It's ironic you say I don't play too many visual novels, like, because the biggest thing back in the day was, you know, I love things like Another Code, Hotel Dusk, like all those sort of games were, you know, my jam. I even had a fan site dedicated to him. So I'm kind of insulted you say I don't play visual novels. But Danganronpa around the time was essentially you had, you know, the similar sort of games coming out, not directly murdering, you know, or villainous like that, but you had, you know, your Ace Attorney series, you know, which was, you know, that similar sort of vibe. You also had a few other visual novels at the time, which were, you know, set in a school environment. So it was sort of like a natural progression, as Guinea said, into that world to be like, well, this is a little bit quirky. This is a little bit different. I want to see what's going on here. And then you sit down, you play it, and you're like, what is happening? Like, why are people dying? So it's sort of like one of those sort of games where, you know the premise, but you're not really too sure why it's happening until you get immersed into the world. And I think that was the brilliance of a game like that, that, you know, you're halfway through the game by the time you even start questioning it. And then you're like, well, I'm just going to go with the flow because I'm enjoying it so well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you wouldn't get so immersed in the world if it wasn't so well written, is the other thing that, you know, really strikes out about Danganronpa compared to a lot of other games. And I must admit, I haven't been able to get into the Ace Attorney series. I know that's blasphemy to say, but it's true. I tried to play a couple of them, didn't really get into them. What I found with Danganronpa is. It's just so, it's a word, kind of, it's so darkly satirical. It's so witty. It's so, it's just so nasty in terms of the writing, but in a kind of very charming way. And it's kind of, as a result, it becomes this kind of page turner, virtual page turner, where I just couldn't put it down because, you know, I was constantly having my eyes kind of bulging at just what was actually going on. And yeah, that kind of sustained me through, what are they? They're about 30-hour long games. They're not short.
Mm,
and yeah. Danganronpa, the original Danganronpa, is about 30 hours, I think. So it's certainly not a short game, but it's hard to stop playing once you start.
Yeah, I agree. I think that commentary that you were talking about, I guess, humanity's motivations and what people are like, that was probably, and I mean, the whole concept of despair and society being so affected by anarchy and suffering and people wanting to spread that sort of feeling around the world, obviously highly satirical, but when you think about how, I guess, people consume media and the way Danganronpa 1 was basically about, these students were basically killing themselves, and it was they were going to show it on TV, or they were showing it on TV, and the reason they were doing that was to basically instill despair and take away hope from people by showing what would be, you know, intelligent, promising students basically murdering the future of humanity. And I found that, while it was incredibly dark at the time, and I was really shocked when, you know, I got the twist and I was like, oh, that's happening. You can definitely see, while it's satirical, it sort of is like a biting commentary on the way that we consume media, I think, and the way media can affect people's moods, and the way media has such a profound impact on the reception of certain events in the world. So I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, that and the way that each kind of character is only kind of half a name and half a role as such, because each character is like the ultimate something or other. So ultimate baseball star, ultimate serial killer. I don't know, what was Toko's ultimate writer, I think she was, and then she turned out to also be a serial killer. So ultimate writer, ultimate athlete, ultimate kung fu, whatever. Everybody has like an ultimate fanfic writer.
I feel like we're remembering too many from the other series.
Yeah, but I mean, each series has the same structure, where each character is like an ultimate something. And, you know, I found that to be a strong commentary on the way that we categorize people in the world, that everybody is like a thing rather than a name. And ultimately, the thing that they are kind of doesn't matter, because, you know, the burliest, toughest guy falls to, you know, a murder plot just as easily as anybody else. So, I found that interesting too, the way it tries to dehumanize people by categorizing them by their roles rather than their names and personalities. And of course, as we are players, so we get to know the personalities as well. And there's that contrast between the kind of the society's expectations on people and, you know, what a more closed group would see of one another.
Well, even then, as you play, you're obviously putting those people, because they've got skills and it's the ultimate X or ultimate Y sort of thing, you're sort of slotting them into what you perceive those people should be anyway. And then you're, as you're playing the game, they're either meeting your expectations as, you know, what you expect someone like that would be, or they're actually blowing them apart and you're like, wow, what, you know, why did I think this way anyway?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And then the other thing I wanted to mention about Danganronpa, I think, is just great, is the actual the presentation of it. it's a stunning game. I think we can all agree on that. The graphical style of it, it's not realistic by any means, and that hyper-stylized approach is really effective. Especially for me, the thing that kind of really stood out was the way that, you know, blood is colored rather than red. Red's a color, but it's kind of a highly stylized kind of comic book like aesthetic. And yeah, I really like that. The character designs are amazing. I was kind of half joking about staying for the waifu. There were a lot of characters that I really liked. And the music is amazing. It's one of the soundtracks I went and bought when I was in Japan, because yeah, the music is oddball. It's not a conventional soundtrack by any means, but again, that kind of reinforces the very surreal approach that the game takes to storytelling in a lot of ways. Okay. So on that note, we might give it a wrap for this week. I hope you all enjoyed the podcast. Thanks for being on, Trent and Ginny.
No worries.
And always good to have everybody on. And yeah, it was good to chat about Danganronpa and stuff. I'm so looking forward to seeing what happens next for that series, because I mean, Danganronpa itself kind of finished with that trilogy. I think the third one was a definite end to the story that was started in the first.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see if what they do with Danganronpa 4, or you know, how
maybe
they
like
look
a
at
reboot
it.
Or a something. I don't know if the game's old enough for a reboot, but
it'd be hard to reboot because like it's all about the plot twists and Danganronpa, people know about those.
Danganronpa spin-off series possible.
Yeah, spin-off would be good. I mean, they did a really good job with spinning it off with that one
Ultra Despergers.
Yeah, Ultra Despergers. Yes. They did a really good job with that as a spin-off. So maybe that's the next step for Danganronpa. I don't know if it needs to be another shooter thingy. But you know, something else would be good.
Maybe some sort of political drama game where it's like happening outside of the world at the same time. Like I would like to see the outside world a bit more, if that makes sense. Like
it would be hard to keep the Danganronpa format for that though. Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know.
Because that's one of the strong things I liked about the anime. Oh, I like the anime. Everyone's like, quiet now. Yeah, one of the things I liked about the anime, which was at the end of the, you know, it was wrapping up the third series, or was a prequel to the third series, episode season. And essentially that, you know, because it showed more of outside the schools, outside of the locations which have been used for these, you know, games, I guess, is one way to describe it, is an interesting, you know, way to expand the universe and get you sucked in. It's like, oh, there's stuff happening out there, because that's, you know, it works in the favor in the games that it's sort of a mysterious outside world, but I would like to know what's actually happening in the outside world. Like, it just doesn't really, like, I'd rather know, well, is there something happening to stop this, or why is it so overthrown to despair? Maybe something which happens at the same time the first game happens, so you can see the despair sinking into people, maybe like something like that, to sort of understand how it could be so easily spread. I know logistically it can, but something like that could work in a game and spin the series into an interesting direction. So
yeah, I mean, we got a sense a little bit, I guess, of the outside world thanks to Ultra Despair Girls, which takes place in a city rather than a enclosed area. So a little bit of that, but yeah, I agree. It'd be nice to get a little bit more. But that, or I don't know, maybe they could do a Danganronpa dancing all night. That'd be pretty cool.
Oh, yeah.
Monokuma twerking. That'd be pretty awesome to see.
Yes.
Monokuma twerking game. That'd be pretty good. I don't know. There's all kinds of crazy places they can take this series. The way they've built it is it could be taken in any direction they really wanted to. So fingers crossed. They come up with something as
a Pokemon
crazy
game. You catch all the Monokumas.
Or an RPG, a team of Monokumas go around and, I don't know, slaughter stuff. You get to be the Monokumas. That'd be pretty interesting. But yeah, on that note, we'll go to some music from Danganronpa and give it a wrap for this week. Thanks very much for tuning in, and we will see you next week. Danganronpa.